Today is Thursday, November 15th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, more outcry over the legality of the president's newly appointed acting attorney general. With thousands of homes lost, wildfires continue to rage in California.
We tried to get back up to see our houses yesterday, and they said it's going to be 4 months.
It's going to be happening.
Paradise is gone.
A new report finds hate crimes on the rise in the United States. Also ahead, a popular Scandinavian music group has released a new single. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, gusty, dry Santa Ana winds continue to fan Southern California wildfires, but forecasters say a change in the weather is coming. The fire west of Los Angeles that killed two people flared again before sunrise Wednesday, but the flames are devouring vegetation in rugged, uninhabited mountains. In Paradise, California, in the northern part of the state, with scores of people still missing, National Guard troops searched Wednesday through charred debris for more victims of California's deadliest wildfire as top federal and state officials toured the ruins of a community completely devastated by the flames. Evacuee Howard Taylor says there was just no time to even gather his belongings.
We didn't have 10 minutes to get out of there. We really had to go. It was already in flame downtown. It was already, all the local restaurants and stuff were already engulfed in flames. And, power poles were falling over the street. And a power line fell on my car, and fortunately, it shut off the power.
At least two dozen people who were trapped by a wall of fire in Northern California survived by plunging into a cold lake. The San Francisco Chronicle reported Tuesday that the people plunged into the Concal Reservoir after flames surrounded their homes in a community outside the decimated town of Paradise. At least a dozen were in a caravan of vehicles that got cut off by the fire last Thursday. Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke joined Governor Jerry Brown on Wednesday to visit the leveled town.
This is my fourth trip to California. Unfortunately, every trip this year has been forest fires. And each trip, I say this is the worst fire I've seen. And now we're here today, and this is the worst fire I have seen.
Well, about 7,700 homes were destroyed when the flames hit Paradise, a former gold mining camp popular with retirees, killing now at least 59 people. Earlier, I spoke with Christine Hagedorn, a nurse at Arbor Post Acute Facility in the neighboring town of Chico. Many of her patients were from other hospitals and facilities that had to be transferred to that center.
They were evacuated to a few different hospitals around here. The cardiac unit burnt down, and a few other clinics attached to the hospital burnt down. They brought 75 patients to my facility here that we had to triage and send out to hospitals and other facilities.
Was it because of the conditions they were in at the hospital, or was it because they had further issues related to the fires or smoke?
Both. Both. Some of them came from the hospital. Some came from other care facilities. Some were victims from the fire.
Did you have a chance to actually talk to any of them personally and just see how they were doing? And
I've spoken with family members of my own patients that have come in that have lost their homes. Many of my patients lost their homes, and their wives and husbands have come in distraught, devastated. Many of the nurses and CNAs that I work with that lost their homes have come in completely distraught, not knowing what to do or where to go.
And yet they're coming to work.
And they're coming to work. And they lost everything. They know they're going to need money. I mean, it's amazing because these people are completely devastated and sad, but they're finding the courage to come into work and know that our patients still need them. And they know that financially they're still going to need money to recover.
And I understand that because you're so close to Paradise, your hospital was also filled with smoke.
Yes. In fact, not just the hospital, our facility here, we had to bring in air scrubbers, and we still are running them. Chico's filled with smoke. Mm. Our facility, the first few days, was completely filled with smoke hanging in the air. So we brought in industrial air purifier to not kill our patients. Even as I'm standing here, just looking down the street or anywhere outside, it's smoky everywhere. There's still ashes falling everywhere.
Mm. I know this is traumatic for everybody there, even those that didn't have houses that burned down, just to see the devastation all around you. And I understand that there are at least 100 people missing, many of them seniors, and apparently some of them are family members of people that you know and work with.
Yes, there are still roughly 200 people missing. One in particular, a nurse that I work with, her daughter's grandfather, Richard Brown, he is still missing.
Any idea where he was at the time of the fire, or they just don't know?
Where it started and was rapidly moving, he lived 10 minutes from that location. His truck was still in his garage, and there's been no sign.
His house survived?
No, it burnt down.
The house burned down, but there's no sign of him?
No.
These stories are just horrifying.
It is. There's been over 135,000 acres that have been burned at this point, with over 8,000 structures destroyed. So many family members that are still reaching out and going to evacuation centers to try and find their loved ones that are missing. A lot of the care home facilities up there didn't have time for proper evacuation. People were literally putting elderly patients from facilities in their car and trying to race down the mountain.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard stories of even like a garbage truck driver picking up elderly people.
Yes, a lot of elderly people live in Paradise. There were many, in fact, who couldn't drive, who were standing on their doorsteps and on the sides of the road hoping for someone to pick them up. The fire was so rapid when it came down the skyway, it ended up on both sides to where there were people trapped in their cars, unable to get out. People had to leave their cars. They were instructed to leave their cars and run because they wouldn't make it in their cars. There were people driving down the hills through the trees in the forest to try and evade the fire. People were taking refuge in coffee shops and other structures, hosing the structures down with water, hoping that the fire wouldn't take over those structures. And we have no idea at this point if those people made it or not.
Do you have any idea when people will be allowed to go back in and look, or is it just still too dangerous?
The last we were updated, they said it wouldn't be for probably 2 or 3 months before people would be able to even go back up and look for remains or see if their houses are still standing.
I know this has to be hard on caregivers, on people like you, nurses that are caring for these people that are seeing it all around them, people that are suffering emotionally because of all of this. How do you deal with it? How are you holding up?
Well, one of the most important things I learned coming into the medical field over 10 years ago is you have to build boundaries and walls around your own heart, because if you don't, it's not that you lose any lack of care or empathy. It's to protect yourself that you're able to still continue to work through it and be able to care for people that need it. But with that being said, it is personal, and it's devastating, because when you come into a facility and it's devastating to see half of the people you work with lose their home. It's horrible. And so I myself, I've been here pretty much every day. I've been here for double shifts. I came in today just to be here, to be support staff, to help. It's just awful.
Well, a message board at a shelter for the many people who fled California's deadliest wildfire is filled with photos of the missing, as well as pleas for any information about relatives and friends. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. The British cabinet is backing a Brexit deal after a marathon meeting. A military veteran pushes adaptive athletes forward. Fox News and others back CNN in the fight to regain White House press pass. And Democrats are gaining as more U.S. votes are counted. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. The The U.S. state of Maryland Tuesday challenged the legality of President Donald Trump's appointment of Matthew Whitaker as acting attorney general to replace Jeff Sessions, who was ousted last week as the country's top law enforcement official. The state said the appointment violated federal law and that Trump named Whitaker to the post to protect himself from the ongoing investigation of his 2016 campaign ties to Russia. The Eastern state asked a federal judge in Washington to install Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, the number two official at the Justice Department, in place of Whitaker in order to follow what Maryland says would be the agency's normal succession rules. Republican Senator Jeff Flake said he's concerned about past comments by acting Attorney General Whitaker, criticizing the special counsel's probe into Russian interference in the 2016 presidential election.
The attorney general has been fired, and the authority and the oversight for the investigation was taken away from Rod Rosenstein, the deputy attorney general, and given to someone who has not been Senate confirmed, who has expressed open hostility to the Mueller investigation.
On Wednesday, Flake introduced legislation co-sponsored by Democratic Senator Chris Coons that would protect the special counsel investigation.
President, just the same day that he compelled the resignation of the attorney general, tweeted about the Mueller investigation being a hoax. He has replaced the attorney general not with the deputy attorney general, which would have been appropriate under the succession statute, but instead with an acting attorney general, Matt Whitaker, whose legal ideas are well outside the mainstream.
Well, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell blocked the legislation from being voted on.
We know how the president feels about the Mueller investigation, but he's never said he wants to shut it down. I've never heard anybody down there say they want to shut it down. I think it's in no danger, and so I don't think any legislation is necessary.
Well, joining us now to talk more about the controversial nomination is George Mason University Professor of Governmental Affairs, Robert Deitz. What do you make of this appointment?
A lot of the reaction to Mr. Whitaker, I think, is the fact that he is hostile to Mueller, by all accounts, you know, from his own words. And therefore, people think that, you know, perhaps he's not a particularly good thinker about these issues. One of the things that's been fastened on most is that he believes the absolute classic Supreme Court decision in Marbury versus Madison, decided, I think, in 1835, was incorrectly decided. And that's raised eyebrows, I think, by almost anybody. Marbury versus Madison was the Supreme Court decision in which the Chief Justice Marshall held that the Supreme Court and other federal courts have not only the right, but the obligation to hold federal statutes unconstitutional if they violate the Constitution. In other words, the fact that something has been passed by Congress is not all by itself proof that something is constitutional. And this is a foundation stone of American jurisprudence. I mean, you know, most of the important decisions you can think of, that any of us can think of off the top of our heads, like Brown versus Board of Education, that held that segregation was illegal, the Roe v. Wade, which held that abortion for the first trimester is lawful, all those are constitutional decisions holding either a state or federal law unconstitutional. And this is something, you know, we've been accustomed to for close to 200 years. And so for somebody to come out and say that he thinks that decision was incorrectly decided after all that amount of time is really quite shocking.
Mr. Whitaker also has had pretty strong opinions about the Mueller investigation into Russian meddling and
yes,
potential collusion with the Trump campaign. He's been pretty outspoken previously about his disdain for the investigation, thinking
yes,
it's basically a witch hunt, as something the president has said.
Yes.
He's also basically said that he didn't even believe that the Russians interfered in the U.S. election, even though all of the U.S. intelligence agencies said otherwise. It would seem that would be a likely reason maybe for putting Matt Whitaker into the position so that he could potentially shut the investigation down now with this type of power. This position is the highest law enforcement officer in the country making decisions. So would you say, is this legal and constitutional, putting him in this position? Or because there are already lawsuits and things brewing on this very issue.
The Constitution requires senior appointments to be approved by the Senate. You know, we all know, the Constitution is filled with checks and balances. So the Constitution gives the president the power to appoint cabinet officers. But as a check against that power, to make sure that a president doesn't misuse it, it requires principal officers to be approved by the Senate. And that process is called the advise and consent power. And what people who are criticizing this appointment are saying is, this guy would have a hard time getting such an approval. But in any event, the Constitution requires attorneys general to be advised and consented when a president appoints them. You can see why many people think that this Whitaker decision appointment was unlawful, because if a cabinet officer must be approved by the Senate, he must be approved by the Senate. And so making him acting without that process seems wrong.
The Justice Department arguing that there was one case of an acting attorney general put in place back in the 1800s.
Yeah, indeed, sometime in the 1880s.
And I believe it was only for 6 days, something like
right.
that. Is that a good enough argument?
I don't think so, and I don't think most people who've given this some thought think so. Obviously, the OLC, Office of Legal Counsel, who ultimately works for the president, has come up with a counter-argument. As you know, in the law, there's always a counter-argument. That doesn't mean it's a strong counter-argument. And I think in this case, it's exceedingly weak. You're right about the appointment, I think, was for 6 days. And what OLC has said here is, this appointment is lawful so long as it's temporary. Well, wait a minute, what kind of argument is that? And by the way, what does temporary mean? I don't think it's particularly persuasive. This is going in front of a court now, and we'll see what the court says.
All right, George Mason University Professor Robert Deitz. The number of hate crimes reported in the U.S. jumped by 17% last year, the largest increase since 2001, when the terrorist hijackings on 9/11 fueled a surge in attacks on Americans of Muslim and Arab ancestry. U.S. law enforcement agencies reported a total of 7,175 hate crimes in 2017, up from 2016, and the third consecutive annual increase, according to the Federal Bureau of Investigation, which said in its annual hate crime report on Tuesday. More than 60% of the incidents were designated as crimes against persons, such as assault and intimidation. The victims represented a cross-section of society, with African-Americans and Jews the most frequently targeted victims. Of 34 bias motivation categories tracked by the FBI, all but five reported an increase. I talked about it with Doug Irvin Erickson, assistant professor and director of the Genocide Prevention Program at George Mason University.
This is a problem with FBI data, is that it's very hard to sort of pin down the things that are causing specific rises. And with all crime data, we see these trends, for instance, in sexual violence, violence against women, domestic violence, that it could just be that people are reporting these crimes more. That's always a possibility. But nevertheless, it's pretty clear that there has been a rise. Groups like the Southern Poverty Law Center have been documenting this for a number of years now, and the rise in hate crimes and rhetoric, and the FBI statistics really confirm this scientifically. Getting towards the idea of a cause, for me, coming from my own academic background, studying hate speech and hate crimes throughout human history, you see direct links between hate speech and acts of hate crime. And the reason for that is hate speech usually provides the framework that legitimizes and authorizes, but really legitimizes people to act upon that hate.
We've heard a lot about white supremacists being emboldened by different statements coming out. We've heard a lot of politicians recently during the midterm campaigns saying words matter. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, words matter. And it's not so much that a specific word is linked to a specific action, but rather the words provide a social climate which people who are inclined to act this way believe that it's acceptable to act this way. And oftentimes people take this initiative because they feel like these acts are somehow sanctioned or authorized or permitted, morally permitted.
Do you believe that the political climate in the past year or so has contributed to the upswing?
I think so. The amount of people who study mass violence and genocide have been writing a lot of op-eds in newspapers pointing out that historically we do see these trends. There's a reason why there's an effort to ban hate speech as a form of incitement to mass violence around the world. Not so much that leaders say things, say hate speech as a way of trying to convince people to go do these terrible things, but rather hate speech itself is a way of inciting these kinds of acts.
This report came out just 2 weeks after this mass shooting at a synagogue in Pittsburgh that killed 11 people.
There's been a lot of really good research recently, globally, looking just at human societies around the world, that speeches by leaders in the aftermath of violence that's ethnically or racially or identity-based, religiously charged, speeches of inclusion and compassion and empathy toward, and that help get rid of this idea that there is such a thing as an other group, those speeches can actually be really shown to de-escalate tensions and prevent a lot of future violence. They have to be clear and unequivocal, and they have to be authentic. And so there's a group of scholars affiliated with the Holocaust Museum have really proven this, that the messages of elites and leaders at points of crisis, it doesn't have to be a killing. It can be something of high tensious moment where, you know, lots of hate speech is flowing around. Those messages by leaders of inclusion and tolerance, acceptance, and rejecting this othering of people is really, really, really crucial for the prevention of hate crimes.
African Americans and Jews were the most frequently targeted victims. This is really something that doesn't seem to have changed much.
Well, these are longstanding patterns. Kinds of patterns exist over the span of decades and hundreds of years. They become embedded into cultural beliefs and stereotypes. And those stereotypes, they feel real to lots of people. And that's part of the problem with this, is how do you unwind those stereotypes and deal with them is a very, very complicated thing. But they don't just disappear overnight. It requires a lot of work.
All right, that's Doug Irvin Erickson, assistant professor and director of the Genocide Prevention Program at George Mason University. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hello, this is James Butte, managing editor and host of VOA's Daybreak Africa show. Join us Monday through Friday at 03, 04, 05, and 0600 hours UTC as we bring you the latest Africa news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our mail segment by sending your comments to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. That's Daybreak Africa right here on VOA Africa.
VOA's International Edition continues. Human rights groups are warning of a pending humanitarian crisis in Bangladesh, as Bangladesh makes final preparations to begin sending Rohingya Muslim refugees back to Myanmar, where they had been subjected to extrajudicial killings and other atrocities. As VOA's Bill Gallo reports, the move comes as the United States pressures Myanmar to resolve the crisis.
Confusion and fear in this refugee camp in Bangladesh, where Rohingya Muslims are faced with the prospect of being returned to Myanmar. Some refugees told VOA's Bangla service they don't want to go back.
The Myanmar people tortured us and slaughtered us, so we came here for safety. We came here to seek justice.
We don't ask for much. We just want our rights. If we get our citizenship, we do not need repatriation. We will go back on our own.
Since 2017, hundreds of thousands of Rohingya have fled Myanmar to escape targeted attacks, including murder and rape by the military. The military repression came in response to attacks by Rohingya militants. Last month, Bangladesh and Myanmar announced they would begin returning the Rohingya, a move rights groups say is reckless.
They need justice and they need assurances that they're not going to go right back into a conflict situation where they're going to be persecuted and abused all over again. None of these assurances have occurred.
Fearing a forced return, some Rohingya refugees have fled the camps. Human Rights Watch says Bangladeshi troops are trying to stop people from leaving.
And on top of that, the list that was provided between the Bangladeshi and the Myanmar officials was a list that was essentially taken at random. I mean, I spoke to the head of refugee repatriation in the Bangladesh government, who said, we just took a registration list and used that. So there was no informed consent.
Meanwhile, in Singapore for a regional summit, U.S. Vice President Mike Pence on Wednesday chastised Myanmar's de facto leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, over the crisis.
The violence and persecution by military and vigilantes that resulted in driving 700,000 Rohingya to Bangladesh is without excuse.
Some experts welcome a tougher U.S. response.
You see this miscarriage of rule of law and justice in Burma, where the Burmese military literally acts with complete impunity. I think that it's so important for the U.S. and for the West, for other nations, to really press on these Southeast Asian nations and to say, we're watching you, and we're going to hold those individuals accountable.
Myanmar's government denies persecuting the Rohingya, saying it was only responding to 2017 attacks by a Rohingya armed group. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Washington.
A popular Scandinavian music group has released a new album from its upcoming, or new single from its upcoming album. VOA Border Crossings host Larry London joins International Edition Sarah Williams with all the details.
Today it's a trio from Denmark who go by the name of Lucas Graham. And they were on the scene a few years back with a big hit called 7 Years. You might remember that song. It went on to stream about 225 million streams on Spotify. It was one of the biggest songs of 2012 and earned Lucas Graham a number of award nominations. In fact, they were nominated for 24. They won 2. They were also nominated for 3 Grammys among the 24 nominations. But Lucas Graham are back. It's been a few years. And so now they have a brand new song, brand new album, and they're going out on tour. So we're going to check out the brand new song from Lucas Graham before we discuss the new album. This song is called Love Someone. Here's Lucas Graham.
There are days I wake up and I pinch myself. You're with me, not someone else. 'Cause you still look perfect as days go by. Even the worst ones, you make me smile. I'd stop the world if it gave us time. 'Cause when you love someone, you open up your...
So what is in this new album?
Well, the new album we don't know yet because it isn't out. All we know is the one song that we just heard, Love Someone, which is a beautiful melodic ballad type song. It seems that Lucas Graham have their greatest success in that lane. The lead singer's name is Lucas Graham Forchhammer, and he seems to be the focal point of the band. He's written most of the music. He starred in a Danish television series when he was younger back in Copenhagen. And he says a lot of his music, a lot of his life experience, he's drawn from his personal experiences. His father died in 2012 suddenly, at the young age of 61, he said that had a profound effect on him and who he is and how he performs and what he writes. In fact, the song 7 Years is about his life growing up as a child from 7 years until today. And he sings it to just about anybody who might be experiencing life between the ages of 7 and whatever. And so the band are planning a tour. In fact, in January, they're out on the road in Denmark. And then by February, they'll be here in the United States. Their new album is their third album. It's called The Purple Album. And I'm looking forward to hearing this album because I did interview Lucas Graham as a band. And the lead singer is a very nice guy. He was a new father at the time I spoke to him. His daughter, Viola, is now 2 years old. And I'd be interested to know how much effect being a father has shaped the new album and the sounds of the new album. But these guys are here to stay. I love their sound. I watched them perform the new single on Dancing with the Stars a week ago. And so they're described as a pop soul hybrid band. And I remember Lucas Graham himself telling me one of the stories about growing up in a very, very small town in Denmark, where it was so small they didn't have a police department. He said, that's how small my city was. And, you know, but nice guy, very friendly group. I love their music, and I'm very excited about the new album when it's coming out, which is the Purple Album. And it is, in fact, purple.
Well, that's good.
In case you were wondering. The new song is called Love Someone, and Lucas Graham is today's International Edition.
Thanks a lot, Larry. That's Larry London. He's the host of VOA's Border Crossings.
Someone like I do. You probably never loved someone like I do. You probably never loved someone like I do.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today, but find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, John Ellison. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day.